heartfelt condolences to our listeners on a very doleful day, which the faithful commemorate every year on the 25th of the month of Rajab. Today is the tragic day when the Prophet's seventh infallible heir was martyred in Baghdad through a fatal dose of poison during imprisonment by the usurper Abbasid regime in 183 AH, corresponding to 799 AH. He reposes in eternal peace in the sprawling twin-domed gold-plated shrine of Qazimain, where people flock day and night and pay their respects to him by saluting him in an appropriate manner, such as, "Peace on you, O representative of Allah and the son of his representative. Peace on you, O the decisive argument of Allah and the son of his decisive argument. Peace on you, O light of Allah in the darkness of the ignorant world. Peace on you, O guide who showed the right path. Peace on you, O symbol of religion and piety. Peace on you, O treasurer of the wisdom of the prophets. Peace on you, O vicegerent of the guardians of the past. Peace on you, O depository of the manifest revelations. Peace on you, O possessor of certitude knowledge. Peace on you, O treasury of the messenger's knowledge. Peace on you, O murdered martyr. Peace on you, O son of the messenger of Allah and the son of his successor. Peace on you, O my lord, Musa ibn Ja'far." What you heard were phrases from the special ziyarat, or standard form of salutations, for the seventh infallible heir of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Named Musa in honor of Prophet Moses, peace upon him, he acquired the epithet of Qazim, or the patient one who refrains from anger, in view of the vicissitudes of life through which he passed during the 35 years of his mission. Born in Abwa between the holy cities of Mecca and Medina in the year 128 AH, corresponding with 745 AD, he was only 55 years old when Harun, while immersed in pleasures in Raqqa in Syria, sent a fast-paced emissary to Baghdad to instruct the despicable jailer, Sindi ibn Shahak, to kill the Prophet's heir in such a way that no sign would remain of any foul deed on the body of the victim. It is an irony of Islamic history that charlatans, debauchees, apostates, and infidels masqueraded as caliphs and made Muslims forcibly obey their will by distorting the tenets of religion, while the divinely designated heirs of the Prophet and the inheritors of the pure and pristine Sunnah Wasira, that is, the practice and behavior of the Messenger of God, were persecuted. After having martyred Imam Musa Qazim, peace upon him, the assassin had the court officials testify with signatures on a long scroll that no foul acts had been done and the venerable prisoner had died on a natural death. Sindi then left the corpse on the bridge over the river Tigris unattended. Were the people of Baghdad Muslims? Did they adhere to the practice and behavior of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny? Didn't they know that the corpse was that of the son and successor of the Prophet's sixth infallible heir, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him? then why didn't they oppose the Abbasids? The answers to such questions are obvious. Muslim conscience had died long ago, ever since the caliphate was hijacked at Saqif Bani Sa'de in Medina by a group of usurpers, while the Prophet still lay unburied and while his bereaved Ahlul Bayt or immediate family members whose authority and purity God himself has vouchsafed in the Noble Quran were busy in the state of mourning performing the last rites of the seal of messengers. So there is nothing to be surprised at the attitude of self-styled Muslims, whether in the past, when the chosen ones of God were brutally martyred, or at present, when innocent and defenseless men, women, and children are either mercilessly bombed by Saudi aircraft in Yemen, or torn to pieces by bomb blasts in Afghanistan, triggered by Daesh terrorists who shamelessly called themselves Muslim. The faithful, however, remain undaunted. They adhered firmly to the God-given political and spiritual rights of Imam Ali, peace upon him, as proclaimed by the Prophet, and they provided burial to the seventh Imam in Baghdad while assisting his son and successor Imam Reza, peace upon him, who miraculously came from Medina to conduct the last rites of his father. These days as well, despite the dastardly acts of the Takfiri heretics and their terrorist masters, the Americans, the faithful are flocking to the shrine of Imam Musa Kazem, peace upon him, in Qasimain, north of Baghdad, in millions to pay homage. It will not be out of context to cite a passage from Imam Musa Kazem's lengthy sermon to his disciple, the master theologian Hisham ibn Hakam, regarding God-given wisdom and authority. O Hisham, the commander of the faithful Imam Ali, peace upon him, used to say, "No one should sit in the forefront of a session except those who can answer when they are questioned, speak when others cannot, and have the most satisfying opinion. He who does not enjoy these three characters and allows himself to sit in the forefront of a session is surely idiot." These are mind-stimulating words indeed. The passage that you heard instantly turns our attention towards not only the Mosque of Kufa, where Imam Ali, peace upon him, the Prophet's divinely designated vicegerent, used to enlighten minds and souls, but also towards the fate of those in history who ended up becoming eternally damned idiots by making the fatal mistake of usurping the caliphate and sitting in the place of the Ahlul Bayt. Thus, Imam Musa Kazem, peace upon him, as an heir of the Almighty's last and greatest prophet, spared no efforts to spread the truth, even if it meant speaking directly to a tyrannically murderous caliph, such as Harun, who longed for lasting glory, but ended up in the bowels of hell with no sign on earth of his rotten grave, while his victim reigns supreme from Baghdad, where the Shia and Sunni Muslims alike salute at the site of the seventh Imam's shrine with the words, "Ya Bab al-Hawa'ij," or "O Gateway of Boons." His manners were impeccable. Never was he heard speaking roughly or harshly to anyone. Even in the most unpleasant situations, he was seen smiling and bearing the pain gracefully. This was in accordance with the saying of his ancestor Imam Ali, peace upon him, that the faithful keeps his grief confined in his heart while a smile on his face. It is an irony of Islamic history that such a noble person was harassed, imprisoned, and martyred. Here is another passage from the Ziyarat of Imam Musa Kazem, peace upon him, as food for thought. I bear witness that you carried and delivered that for which Allah has commissioned you, protected that which was entrusted to you, prescribed that which Allah has made lawful, forbade that which Allah has made unlawful, made clear the divine rules, studied and interpreted the book of Allah, exercised self-control for the sake of Allah, strived in the cause of Allah, leaving no stone unturned till the inevitable came unto you. I have taken refuge near your grave. Your zarih is my sanctuary. You are my advocate before Allah. I am a friend of your friends. I am averse to your enemies. Well acquainted with your rank and the guidance you adhere to, mindful of the depravity of your opponents and of the waywardness in which they are wandering.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you because you are
a Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear ladies, this is your program. We are in here. That is Muslim Lady. Welcome to a new episode. I am Asma, and in here I have Sister Zainab, as always. We're going to have her to help us with the description that she's going to give us, since we are studying a book, actually, recently, and we are taking the main focus of this book and explain about them. And it's been quite a long time. We've been through too much. Before I actually give more of details, assalamu alaikum, sister, and welcome to today's episode.
Wa alaikum assalam. Thank you so much for inviting me.
And thank you for being here. Well, the last episode, I remember that we talked about general aspects of the way Lady Fatima Az-Zahra salamullah alayha treated her children. And then we went through the spiritual growth, how she cared about their spirits, their souls, and how she helped them grow in that manners. And also we have this important fact as well, which is the physical growth that, again, is going to be on the shoulder of mothers, the Muslim ladies.
So yeah, physical growth, as you said, is a very important part of the child growth. And that again goes back to the mother, because the lunch are being prepared by the mothers, because the everything other is being prepared
they
by the mothers.
They are the food givers.
The mistake that we make is that we think only food is important for the physical growth.
Yeah.
While as Lady Fatima Az-Zahra Salamullah is teaching us, it's also charity, giving away charity, giving away alms. While she's also teaching us for the physical growth of children, just food is not important, but also the giving away alms for the well-being, giving away charity, and taking care of the poor, like showing them, because there have been reports like when they were fasting for a couple of days one after the other, on the iftar time, the poor, the orphans come on their doors, the needy, and they whatever they have for iftar, they give away. So she's actually teaching them physically. You know, for example, sometimes you give away your food or anything you have as alms, as charity to someone, and then
for the well-being of your family.
For the well-being, you know, and that's very important. That's very, Allah is teaching this, that is at so many places in Quran. Like, if I'm giving you something, you give away something. If you need a particular bounty, you also, you know, give away. Do infaq, I don't know, give away charity. There's so much on charity. Wherever there is salat, there is this giving away, you know. So she would actually give away alms, give charity for her children. She would, on the command of Prophet, peace be upon him, she trimmed the hair of her kids and gave as much as silver as the weight of their hair.
When they were born, at the time of their birth.
Yeah, and which is a sunnah, which we also do, and which is a process like Muslims continue.
And they call it aqiqah.
Yeah, and then Prophet, peace be upon him, also, he sacrificed a lamb for them. So yeah, that's also called...
So it's the thing that we have it in our Islamic heritage. When a child is born, they would take...
All these things are important for the physical growth.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if we go and search out there, how important is it trimming the first hair? And because those hair, it remains very soft. The roots do not grow properly and all that, you know, research is done. Yeah. It's out there on the internet.
And then as they trim it, as much as the weight of that hair, they're going to, I guess, buy gold, right?
Gold or silver, whatever you can, you know.
So they buy gold and silver and then they give it as an almond charity.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what is recommended. That's what is being taught by Prophet, peace be upon him. And she was a person who followed it. And then after her, many followed it, knowing the importance of the physical growth of children. It is also reported that once one of the companions, known as Bilal, who was also very famous for the call of prayers, he was once visiting their house and he would see Lady Fatima Zahra, you know, busy in doing the household jobs, like just making the floor. And on the other side, Imam Hussain alayhi salam was very young and he was crying. And then she's confused how to go and rush to a child. And then Bilal comes in and tells her, like, can I help you? Shall I handle the child? Or she tells him, no, you go and do the floor job. You go and just make the floor. It's very important for me to go myself and handle my kid myself. So she knows the importance, like, of being a mother. My child needs mother.
My attention,
actually, rather than anything else. Otherwise,
exactly.
Like, what comes to our mind is, like, as a lady should do the household things, and someone as a man can actually handle a child.
Take care
of
the children.
She knows where attention is important and whose attention is important when. So she was very, you know, careful about this.
Exactly. So now I guess it's time for us to go for a short break and then we'll be back. Today's episode of Muslim Lady, we're talking about the way the greatest lady in this world, Lady Fatima Zahra Salamullah Alayha, treated her children. The woman whose father actually been treating all the children pretty much in a cool manner, in a very much perfect, kind manner. He was always greeting them even before they say hello to him. So he was actually very much kind toward all the children. Now, from this father comes such a mother who's been so kind to all children and also to everyone else, actually.
You quoted this very beautiful narration wherein, like, Prophet, peace be upon him, would go and he would start greeting children before they would come and...
Yeah, and he even played with them.
Then he played with them and then he would laugh with them, giggle around, and which we consider as, oh, come on, I am elder one and I should...
He is the Prophet, you know? He's the Prophet, knowing that he has such a place, such an importance in society.
Position in society.
He was so modest and so kind toward all, and specifically to children.
You know, in Surah Waqia, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that there are three groups of people, like there are Ashab al-Shimal, there are Ashab al-Yameen, and there are Sabiqoon. Those, the ones Sabiqoon are the ones who overtake.
Yeah.
Al-Yameen are the ones who are the righteous people, but they are like kind of little lazy in doing things. Like they won't overtake. And Shimal are the wrongdoers. So how we're not going to discuss about these groups. Why I discussed as Sabiqun as Sabiqun, these are the overtakers.
Exactly.
These are in the front line always. Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family, they have always been among the Sabiqun as Sabiqun. These are the practical examples of the Sabiqun who overtake, who are the first to do. You know, whenever
they are the ones who take the initiative for everything.
That is who are called Sabiqun. You know, Sabiqun are the ones who take initiative, who want to do every kindness, every goodness first.
Yeah.
So he would do salam to children. He would play with children, even her daughter. So when we are talking about, she gave importance to spiritual growth, she gave importance to the physical growth. Equally, she gave importance to the emotional growth of her children.
Mm-hmm.
And in emotional growth, there are so many research done which say that if you do not give emotional attention to your children, they are going to grow up. They are going to come out. They are going to be, when they become adults, they're going to be like, some people have aggressive behavior.
They
have traumas. They you know, go through some psychological disorders, and they have so many, you know, problems.
Consequences would come.
Exactly. If you do not pay emotional attention, and that's all proven now, you know.
Yeah, everyone knows psychologically that. And scientifically.
And how in that time, in that period, when the education was not so much in advance.
So primitive. Everything was so primitive.
She gave the utmost importance to this aspect, the emotional aspect. And in the meantime, she would not ignore her husband. Because what we
now have... this is the point. You know, women are doing too much of a job.
Yeah, because I, as a woman, when I'm playing with my kids, I'll say, I don't have time for my husband.
Exactly.
But see her tricky way and her...
And when are you going to make food?
Her actual wise way of playing with kids.
Yeah.
She would play with Imam Hassan alayhi salam and say, Ishba abaka ya Hassan, waqla'ana al-haqq al-rasan. Which means, be like your father, O Hassan. Remove the rope of oppression from the neck of truth.
Yeah.
So now she's playing with her son, teaching him the spiritual aspect.
So this is her nursery rhyme.
Yeah. And also giving attention to husband.
Mm-hmm.
She's doing three things.
Multitasking.
At the same time.
Yeah.
And I, as a Muslim lady today, have all the excuses, all the, you know, I have pretexts for myself. How can I handle all that?
I can't do all of these things at the
just
same
time.
Just see
how she is doing. Mm-hmm. In a very, very wise way. In a very, very intelligent manner. How she's playing with Imam Hassan alayhi salam. So in the further couplets of her nursery rhyme, she would recite, Wa'abud ilahan zilminan, and worship the Lord who gives you bounties. And do not get closer to those who keep grudges.
Exactly, yeah.
Teaching him ethics at the same time. Teaching him about God at the same time. Teaching him how, you know, merciful Allah is. How he is the owner of all bounties.
Very wise of her as a mother.
These
at the same time that she's playing with them, she's reciting, singing for them this nursery rhyme. And this nursery rhyme has got a lot to say at the very same time.
Indeed.
Yeah. So let's go for a short break, and then we would have some more minutes to wrap it all up.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Dear Muslim ladies, we are talking about the way Lady Fatima Zahra Salamullah Alayha behaved with her children, the way she treated them. We talked about a spiritual growth, we talked about the physical growth and also the emotional growth. And we said that at that very time where everything was so primitive, such a great woman had too much of understanding of the psyche of her children in a way that she did not ignore any single specific detail about their growth. And Sister Zainab actually helped us with that. And I guess that's all about the behavior that
I actually didn't want to make a confusion that it's just the spiritual aspect. the emotional aspect is equally important. The physical aspect of their growth is equally important. All the aspects are very, very important. However, she did not just prioritize the, you know, other stuff that we do today. Actually, I gave the examples.
Exactly, yeah.
Schooling is important. Choosing a school is very, very important. But it's not like sometimes what we do is we realize secular education is being given in a school, but they reject the Islamic knowledge, or they are teaching, they are actually infusing something
and
else.
Also I
we
would
prefer
say that,
that school over any other school wherein Islamic teaching is given. So that should not be done. What I'm trying to say is that spiritual aspect should not be ignored, or the material aspect should not be given priority over the spiritual
one. It shouldn't be prioritized to other needs of the children. And also I would think that giving a perfect schooling to a child is very much important, but the attention and the care that the child needs from their parents, specifically from the mothers, because they spend more time with them, is something that is indispensable.
You
cannot change it with anything else.
You actually have to be, you know, be very, very careful when it comes to upbringing, because Lady Fatima Zahra Salamaleh is teaching us so much. The emotional aspect, the physical aspect, the spiritual aspect, nothing should be ignored.
Exactly.
And what I would like to say in the end to all women, listen to your children. Because a child does not say, I am stressed or I'm distressed. What a child says is that, can you play with me?
Exactly. Yeah, that's the point. So you must have a plan as a Muslim woman. And then you must prioritize the needs of your children and listen to them. And then be with them always, be their shoulder, and that's it. Yeah, that's all the mothers, kind mothers, would do with their children. Thank you, Muslim ladies. Until another session, I say farewell, and may Allah protect you and shower you with His blessings. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen. To me, this waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free. Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, brothers and sisters, dear listeners, welcome to Mafatihul Hayat, Keys of Life. I am your host, Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi. One of the keys of life is maintaining our mental health. And mental health, first and foremost, begins with the brain. Right. Now, the Ahl Bayt alayhim as-salam, they said a person, a mu'min, a believer, needs to maintain the functionality of his intellect because he needs it. Without it, he is nothing. Now, when we look at the hadith, they tell us there are a number of factors that I could indulge myself in and they will have a very bad negative impact. Which means I lose my mentality, I lose my sanity, I lose my ability to think and become a person with common sense. I lose all that. Let's look at a number of things that the Ahl Bayt touch upon. One is al-ujub, self-conceit. When a person thinks, I am the best thing that God made, I look in the mirror and I see myself and I say, wow, man, you're just
beautiful, just handsome, hands down. There's no one like you, right? Or sometimes I have a title in front of my doctor, professor. And, you know, when people call me these names, I take a pride in myself, self-conceit. Or sometimes I do actions and acts, and sometimes like acts for the sake of Allah. You can be paying charity, doing good work, and people come and praise you, and then you have this moment of self-conceit. I am good, aren't I? That, the Ahl Bayt say, that's a cause for the brain to lose its functionality. Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, he says in a hadith, "Ujbu al-mar'i bi nafsih ahada husadi aqlah." He says a person's self-conceit is one of the people who are jealous of himself. So you know, when I see a person who has something and I get jealous of them, I make them lose what they have. Like, I'm like, I wish they lose what they have. When a person has that self-conceit in himself, says, "Oh wow, I am so good," he's literally trying to get that away from himself. So the Imam says, وَسُيُؤَدِّي إِلَى فَسَادِ عَقْلَهِ. That self-conceit, thinking that you are God's gift to mankind, he said it will make you lose your mind. In the sense, they are no longer being rational and making common sense. So that's a no-go zone. Two, Amir al-Mu'mineen says, "Man sahaba jahilan naqasa aqlu." He who befriends an ignorant person will lose his mind. Now, think of it logically. When a person becomes a friend with an idiot, an ignorant, what is he going to gain from them? Nothing. Rather, when he needs to deal with them, he needs to turn off and switches off his intellect and his mind in order for him to deal with such a friend. So the Imam says, if you have a friend or if you know someone who's ignorant and idiotic and stupid, try to avoid them. Not make them your friends, because they will affect the way you think. They will affect the way you act. They will affect your even akhlaq. Because Imam alayhi salam, he says himself, "Tell me who your friends are and I'll tell you who you are." If I walk and I have friends and mingle amongst the idiots and ignorant, I'm going to be considered to be one of them. So for the safety of our brains, let us avoid self-conceit and being with ignorant people. Let us take a short break and we'll look at some more factors.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatih al-Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree.
امام همونطوری که این رو گفته بارم گفته دی اون امامی که گفته اگر روزه بگیری ثواب داره همون امام گفته که اگر درخت بکاری اون ثواب داره.
Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree.
محیط زیست نگه سالم نگه داره این دقل ثواب داره.
There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment.
وقتی میخوای کشاورزی کنی یه قدر گندم بگیر رو به قبله بیست این دعا رو بخون اینم هم امام گفته دیگه.
When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned.
تو نظام اسلامی این جلد دوم جاش خالی.
We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are still listening to the program Mafatih al-Hayat, Keys of Life, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. Some of the factors that makes me lose my mind and the functionality of my mind are mentioned in the hadith of the Ahl Bayt alayhim as-salam. One of the factors the Ahl Bayt alayhim as-salam say, to avoid, a person avoids listening to logical people when they give him advice. Now, and this is just a, you know, normal, a common sense thing, that sometimes I want to do something that I feel like something I like, I want to do, I enjoy it, I get a pleasure out of it. And I say to myself, well, obviously my brain is saying, well, hold on, that actually could be harmful. How about you ask someone for advice? I ask someone for an advice and he says to me, oh, you know what? You should not be doing that. And then I say, yeah, I know, but I'm still going to do it. Now, that is just stupid as it gets. Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullah alayhi, says a person who asks an intellectual for advice but never applies it is killing his brain. He says, he who leaves and refrains from listening to the advice of the intellectuals, his brain will die. Because if you're not listening to people who are intellectual, then obviously you are not learning anything, are you? Obviously not. So there is this kind of emphasis that I always need to go back and ask people of intellect, ulil albab, those who have brains. One. Again, Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi says, man ghalab alayhi al-hazalu fasad aqluh. He who constantly jokes will lose his mind. Because joking all the time and just trying to crack jokes and make fun, obviously you're not thinking anymore. You're not thinking of anything good. You're not developing your brain. You're not developing at least your intellectuality. You're just trying to make people laugh. So you're losing your mind rather than making it grow. So the Imam says, that will corrupt and pollute your mind. He says, fasad aqlu. He uses the word fasad. Fasad is corruption. So think of it like this. Your brain is this bowl of water that is just pure and calm and you can see through. And then all of a sudden you put a drop of ink. And then all of a sudden that water becomes polluted and no longer you can see through it. The Imam says, joking too much will have that effect. It will pollute your mind, so avoid it. Again, he says, man kathura mizahuhu istahmaq. He who constantly also jokes, he'll become an idiotic person. Ahmaq means an idiot in Arabic. Istahmaq is like the extremity, become an extreme form of being an idiot, becomes idiotic. So he just becomes an idiotic person. Why? Because he's constantly joking. Which means no longer a person is logical, no longer rational. Now, sometimes we seem to think that when we're cracking jokes in front of our friends, they're laughing, we get a joy out of it. Okay, but don't overdo it. You know, once or twice, it's required, you know, to keep things flowing. But make sure it doesn't become a part, it doesn't become a habit. You don't turn to be a comedian, right? Because that will definitely affect the intellectuality. That will affect the power of the mind, which we need to keep immaculate all the time. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children scream.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
Fishermen in the Gaza Strip. Palestine overlooks the Mediterranean Sea to the east with a coast 224 kilometers long. This coast starts from Ras al-Nakura in the north to Rafah in the south. A long history, People living in all coastal cities, including Acre, Haifa, Jaffa, Ashdod, and Ashkelon, have worked in fishing as their major profession to earn income. The fathers inherited the profession from the grandfathers, and now their sons inherit this profession.
We are fishermen, father and son. Fishing is our only craft in life. My father, my brother, my grandfather, my uncles, and I are all fishermen. We have no craft other than fishing and the sea.
Since Palestine was occupied by the Zionist gangs in 1948, fishing as a profession has been subject to many violations, like the occupation of all Palestinian coastal cities and forcefully displacing their inhabitants, who found refuge in the Gaza Strip and resided in coastal refugee camps. Faiz Abu Ful is a fisherman originally from Hammam village near Majdala, and Adham Al-Habil is a fisherman originally from Al-Jora village near Ashkelon, and both are coastal villages in the occupied Palestine in 1948. These two fishermen used fishing as their major profession, which they cannot live without.
My name is Faiz Ahmed Abu Ful from Ashata refugee camp. I work as a fisherman. I am married and have a family of 12 in my house. Our capabilities as fishermen do not cover one quarter or one third of our needs. Every day, I leave the house at 5:30 a.m. and walk to the port. We all come here to the port very early in the morning, around the dawn time. Then we get on the boats, depending on Allah, and follow the fish wherever they go, east or west, from Sudania area to Rafah. To the west, we are allowed to go only 3 nautical miles, where fish is very scarce. Some days we can't find any fish. This is our life. We can't live a different life, and we don't have any other profession.
Hence, one of the violations by the Israeli occupation is limiting the distance allowed for fishing to 3 nautical miles and allocating gunboats to chase Palestinian fishermen who exceed this 3 miles, where fish is scarcely found. Adham and Faiz's boats were attacked when Adham tried to sail to an area where plenty of fish could be found.
3 years ago, we were 1 nautical mile away from the port in Sudania area, riding 4 boats. An Israeli gunboat came and started shooting at us. My boat was in the back and other boats were in front of me. They kept shooting at us for 10 minutes and we stopped. We had to stop, otherwise they would keep shooting and call us with microphones to force us to stop. They closed up on us and kept shooting for about an hour while we will stand still. The boats were hit and holes started leaking water. They started shooting right at fishermen, so they jumped in the water while I got stuck on the boat. Suddenly, one boat got on fire. They hit it with a shell, which directly hit the gas tank, which made it catch on fire very quickly. The boat for Habil family was burned, so the other boats closed up at it and tried to put the fire off. The gun boat left the area, so one boat was able to get close and drag it to the shore.
A month and a half after the boat was burned, it was fixed, and Adham and Faiz went back fishing. Fishing as a profession is the major source of income for more than 3,000 fishermen and hundreds of others in the Gaza Strip.
After I pray Fajr or dawn prayer, I take my stuff, I go to the fish market. Fish market starts around 6 a.m., so every day I buy some fish and take it to the public market to sell it from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. While staying there, I see different kinds of people, those who can buy and those who can't buy because of poverty. You can see these things from dealing with the people. At the end of the day, you have a lot of things that bother you, and you could make a poem of our lives out of it. I mean how we are humans and we feel for one another. It is these things that we feel that make us right.
Hossein Qasim did not limit himself to writing poetry.
his interaction with people, and getting introduced to their grief provoked him to write scripts and scenarios for plays and feature films.
I wrote four plays for children. Two of them were produced, while the others were not. I wrote 60 radio episodes. I used to be a radio director, and I directed 120 radio episodes. I wrote a series of 13 episodes. I also wrote a script for a long film named Bleeding of a Heart, talking about the suffering of prisoners in Israeli jails and the suffering of their families, which is based on a novel from Mohammed Nassar named Screams. I also wrote the full script for another film named Volcano under supervision of Dr. Nabil Abu Ali.
Hossein Qasim continued writing till he got the chance to stand on the stage and in front of the camera to play major roles in many plays, series, and films.
In 1996, I went to an organization named Al Auda for theater and arts. We produced two plays, one named Counted on Who, and the other called The Good Land. Then I shifted to TV work. We produced a Bedouin series called Paths of Yearning. We also produced another series called And You, Jerusalem, Al-Quds, talking dramatically about the Judaization of Al-Quds and how the Israeli occupation tries with all means to take over the houses around it, either by offering money or threatening the owners, along with other means. I also acted the role of a Palestinian prisoner, showing all sorts of torture and suffering they go through in Israeli jails.
If anybody listens to the artist Hossein Qasim, a pressing question will jump into his mind about the reasons why he's selling fish in the market.
This is the reality in our country. As an artist, I have to find another job to be able to earn money to live. Otherwise, I will starve. Because how often will any producer make a film? Every year or once in 2 years? And how much will he give me per film? How much will he even profit from the film to give me? Is he going to be able to give me a fixed monthly salary to pay my rent and live with my children? He will not be able to do that. So I have to find another job. In short, honestly, you have to be an artist with nothing. An artist who can't feed himself. An artist who can't feed his family. I wrote something about that, which says, I am an artist and have a right to be human. I am an artist and have the right to take my art anywhere, to Tunisia, to Syria, or Lebanon. I am an artist, and do you believe that? Till now, I don't have a phone and don't have an address.
This is the condition of the artist Hossein. However, Wissam, who's an actor, is in a different condition. At night, he works as an actor on stage for wedding parties in the streets, while in the morning, he works as an electricity technician to feed his family, which cannot depend on what he will gain from acting.
We did the street theater, or what we call the weddings theater. We used to get almost no money for it. After a year or two of doing it, we started to get $5. The first time I got the $5, felt like I received $100,000. When I stood in front of the camera in the film on the Palestinian leader, Awad Selmi, Rifle Lover, I did two things. First, I worked as an electricity technician. Second, I acted in the film. I was paid for the electricity work more than for the acting. This is a real catastrophe, to be paid for electricity work more than my acting.
The Rifle Lover was Wissam's second film, in which he stood in front of the camera, while the first film was Imad Aqil, which he didn't get paid for, and played the role of a spy for the Israeli occupation. Here, the surprise was after the film was showed.
I faced many obstacles and still suffer after the film on the Palestinian leader, Imad Agil. I do not suffer from the film, but from the role I played in the film. Today, I got used to it. When I walk in the street, somebody would say, "Hey, you're a spy," and I would smile at him. But I would say to myself, this is not a problem. As long as the people know me and remember me, this is a success. This acceptance from people makes me feel better.
This is regarding art in Palestine, but equestrian has a different story as well.
This club was founded in 1993. There were a group of horsemen who used to organize races near the eastern borders. They were frequently harassed by the Israeli occupation soldiers. They sent a request to the late president, Yasser Arafat, to allocate a place for them to organize the races, and he gave them this 30 dunam piece of land. But unfortunately, there were a lot of obstacles, especially financial ones, which prevented equestrian from being practiced as desired.
The management of the club faces a lot of difficulties in getting the horses in. Second, horses in Gaza are very scarce and it is very hard to find good ones. Another problem is prices of the horses, as not every horseman can afford a horse, and this puts pressure upon the management of the club, which cannot provide all these horses. This is a big problem.
After the Equestrian Club was founded in northern Gaza, Al-Faisal Equestrian Club was founded in Gaza City. These are the only two clubs in the Gaza Strip that teach horsemen and horsewomen on hurdle jumping. This sport requires having trained horses as well as talented and qualified trainers to arouse the sport in a country where this sport never existed before.
We in the Al-Faisal Equestrian Club are the second place in the Gaza Strip to produce strong Palestinian horsemen. The largest portion of our activities is for hurdle jumping, which takes up to 80%. 10% goes to races and 10% to shows of Arab horse beauty. Hurdle jumping is the main focus of the club, so we can participate in external tournaments. All the horses we use here are trained locally. We train them. We didn't buy trained horses from outside. Therefore, we believe that many of our horses are not qualified to participate in external tournaments. So, when a Palestinian horseman wants to compete outside Palestine, he will have to rent horses from the country he is competing in. When the horseman is not used to the horse he is riding, and the horse is not used to him, this is a very serious problem for the horseman to achieve anything.
Sixteen-year-old Ayal Ajrami is a horsewoman training on hurdle jumping. With hopes of achieving an ambition, she has always dreamed of representing Palestine in international tournaments.
My ambition is to become a famous horsewoman and to participate in tournaments and win high ranks. This way, I would represent Palestine and show the world that Palestine is a country that has a horseman like any other country, a country that has everything as all other countries have.
We try to interact with the Arab countries, as most of the tournaments there are based on hurdle jumping. So we always try to pick a suitable team, and we have won advanced ranks in various occasions. We have a good group of horsemen who can achieve impressive results to whichever Arab country you send them.
If Aya wants to continue training on hurdle jumping, to participate in international tournaments, she has to own a horse to train with anytime she wants.
I have a horse that I bought about a month ago. When I bought it, we faced a lot of difficulties getting it through the side of the Israeli occupation, and it was very hard to get it in. At the same time, this horse doesn't have all the desired qualities found in external horses.
Ayal Ajrami wishes to someday represent Palestine in international tournaments in hurdle jumping. However, Mohammed Fannouna, who is handicapped, had already participated in international tournaments for athletics and won various medals. He stood in front of the podiums with pride despite the hard circumstances this Palestinian champion went through.
Regarding visual impairment, B1 is totally impaired, B2 is partially impaired for a certain level, and B3 is partially impaired for a lower level. I am diagnosed with B3, which is considered the lowest category. In Athens, I won the bronze medal for long jumping, and in 2010, I won a gold medal in the ASEAN in Guangzhou, China. I also participated in the world tournament in 2002 and won 4th place in long jumping and 5th place in javelin. In the year 2000-2001 in Tunisia, I won 2 gold medals in long jumping and javelin. Each country had a protocol of sounding the national anthem, so my feelings at that moment described themselves as a Palestinian athlete who was able to get there and reach that level despite the hard circumstances we live, being political division, siege, and lack of resources. There are countries that created a character and status and value for themselves through sports, and this is related to willpower. The Palestinian people are persecuted and occupied, and willpower is their strongest weapon. However, the disabled who belong to Palestine and are Palestinian athletes should be given more attention and support, and we have to all learn from them.
What we can learn from the handicapped is their ability to achieve victories. Hamid Zakout is an international athlete in javelin, discus throwing, and shot put. He won various medals in international tournaments, but he suffers from very hard circumstances, which any handicapped athlete suffers in getting to the podiums.
These are the achievements in Arab and international tournaments. We have proved our ability to the world, despite all the suffering and hard circumstances we went through, especially the siege, in the full meaning of the word siege. And despite our humble resources, or simple resources, or maybe I can say without any resources, compared to the large countries we have faced and beaten in these competitions. One of the major obstacles is that the athlete needs an income to continue. If I were not an employee, I wouldn't have come to train in the first place, and sports wouldn't be important to me, because I would be concerned mainly about supporting my family and fulfilling their financial needs.
Numbers of people with special needs rise day after day in Palestine as violations by the Israeli occupation continue. During the war in Gaza in 2008-2009, about 5,000 Palestinians were injured. 600 of them were disabled, and they were mostly youth. Therefore, some civil society organizations started to respond to some of their needs, which was the case with Al-Taysir Society for Marriage and Development.
The goal or mission of Al-Taysir Society is to provide some financial support to needy young men to get married. In 2010, we decided to help young men who were injured during the war because they became a deprived group. After they were young and strong and able to do anything they want, they suddenly became disabled and unable to do basic things. We found it our duty as Palestinians who can help these people to take the decision of helping them by providing anything they need to get married.
Munzer Krayem is one of those who were injured during the war by shrapnel of drone missile while he was walking in one of the streets in Gaza.
I was injured on the 4th of January 2009. We were in Jaffa Street after evacuating our house during the war. I was injured in my left leg, my cheek, and my neck. My injury in the left leg caused a disability, as it became 10 centimeters shorter. In the surgeries I had, they took bones from my right leg and put them in the left leg, so the shortage became 8 centimeters.